I'm Ray Moss, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I've had a wonderful time. Last night, coming in yesterday afternoon from the airport, I didn't see a bit of construction down our way. They're tearing up everything, building everything, and it was just so peaceful to get on the road coming this direction. And Steve came and got me, and his hospitality has been wonderful. And I want to thank the committee for calling in, writing in for the calls that Steve made, and we got to know each other over the telephone, and it's been just a real pleasure. This is Malachi and I were talking last night. What a very friendly, warm place this is. If I didn't know better, I think I was in North Carolina. Thank you so much for your hospitality. My wife, who is a very active member of Al-Anon, told me last night to be sure to say hello to all the Al-Anon folks. And I say that to you so that I won't be not carrying out her orders. Let me share a story with you that I heard not long ago, and it'll help me settle down. I need a minute or two to do that, if you'll allow it. The old wino on the streets of Washington got ready to go to bed that night, and he unfolded his paper and laid it down in the doorway, crawled on one part of it and pulled the other part over him and slept pretty good. Had his bottle with him, and the next morning he got up, took another hit off his bottle and shook himself a little bit, straightened up best he could, folded his paper up and stuck it under his arm and walked down to the subway and got on. And he looked around for a seat, and he saw a seat vacant over here beside the Catholic priest. And he just sat it over, smelling bad and looking bad, and sat down beside the priest. And the priest really didn't want him there, but he couldn't move, so he just moved over as close as he could to the other person. And the old boy unfolded his paper and sat there like a businessman. A few minutes, he looked up at the priest and said to him, do you have any idea what causes arthritis? And the priest looked at him and said, I can tell you exactly what causes arthritis. It's sleeping in the doorways, on the dampness, not getting proper rest, and drinking alcohol. That causes arthritis. And he said, do you have it bad? He said, oh, no, I don't have it at all, but I read here in the paper that the Pope has it very severely. I like that story. Let me share one other with you. You may have heard this, some of you, but I've just been amazed at the number of youthful people here. And I don't know how long they've been in the program, but they're youth. They're just, some of you are less than 25, and some of you are less than 20. And what an amazing sight to see. And it's warming my heart to look at you. So you old timers have heard this, but some of the new people haven't. So it gives me the privilege to tell it. The telephone rings, and a quiet little voice says, hello. And the voice on the other end said, may I speak with your mother? Mother is busy. Well, who else is there? Daddy. Let me speak to Daddy. He's busy. Anybody else there? The fireman. Well, let me speak to the fireman. They're busy. Anybody else there? Well, let me speak to the police. They're busy. And the voice says, well, what are all those people doing? They're looking for me. Oh, my God. I lived in hell so long that my wife and I just absolutely insist on having a good time. We try never to have a bad day, and we share a lot of fun fellowship with each other, and we share it with other people. And I believe that sobriety brings that. It's brought it to us, and I want to say if you haven't found that yet, if you haven't got happy and joyous and free, keep coming back, keep working the steps, get you a sponsor that smiles a lot, and that maybe those things will help you get to the point in your life you can be happy with your sobriety. I came here to tell you what it was like and what happened to me and what it's like today, and I want to try to do that to the best of my ability and as honestly as I can. I was born in a little town called Kannapolis, North Carolina. You don't have any idea where it is, and I couldn't try to explain it to you. It's near Charlotte, North Carolina. And back when I was born in the early 30s, Kannapolis was a mill town, a textile town, a little town owned by one man, and there were thousands of people that worked in this textile plant. And the gentleman built houses around that textile plant for his workers. And my granddaddy lived in what was known as a mill house, textile family. It was called the Mill Hill that I grew up on. My mom and daddy lived in a mill house because they worked in the textile factory. And it was a little three-room house, didn't have a bath. Everything I knew, everything I ever wanted to know about the human anatomy, I learned it in that house because there wasn't any place to hide or get away from each other. You just stood there naked sometime and you just knew everything about everybody. I didn't like that house. I didn't like my mom and daddy working in the mill, and I certainly didn't want to be, I didn't like being called a leadhead. That was the name for cotton mill workers. I didn't like that. At an early age, I said, if I get a chance, I'm going to leave. I had no idea where I'd go, but I was going to get away from there. That little house that I grew up in had an impact on my life because the people that lived in that house were mom and daddy and my sister and I. Dad was the alcoholic in that family, and mama was that person who constantly, in my mind, made him drink with her mouth, you know, just always at him. And I knew that if she didn't say anything, he wouldn't get drunk. But mama said if he didn't get drunk, she wouldn't say anything. But, you know, it was that vicious cycle round and around. I learned a whole lot in that little house. I learned a lot from my dad. The most important thing that I learned from him was how to drink. Because in that little house, mama wouldn't let daddy drink anywhere, and she was the strong individual there. And she wouldn't let him drink in the house, but on the side of the kitchen was a little room called the pantry. And mama kept her flour and her meal and all the stuff that she put together, good food, in that little 3x5 pantry. And that was the only place dad could take a drink. Now, he drank like this. When he was a periodic, sometimes he'd go a month or two and not have a drink. I can't believe it, but there are people like that. He had a jar that sat on the floor in the right-hand corner of that little pantry. And when he'd get ready, mama said he's mean as hell, watching. And now I know the big book says he was restless and irritable and discontent. And we didn't know what to call it in those days, but mama said, Dad, your daddy's getting mean as hell, so watch him. But when he got mean like that, he went to that little pantry and he shut the door. But I could hear him inside, and he would screw off the top of that jar, strip that bag down, screw off the top, and turn it up and take a drink, and he sang a little song. And it went like this. God almighty, that's good. And he'd go in about two or three times, and maybe the third time, this old man's attitude changed. He was a mild and meek little fellow. Mama kept him whooped down. But when he had a drink or two and got about the third in him, he came out and he wanted to make love with mama and he wanted to dance. And she wouldn't have anything to do with him, but he'd get mad and they'd start an argument and he'd be gone. And you know, that man never, sometimes he'd be gone 2 or 3 weeks. What stuck in this young mind was not that he was gone and not that they had an argument, but wonder what happened when he went in the pantry and came out. I liked Joe when he stood up to be a man after he had a drink. And I said, someday, when I get a chance, I'm going to slip me some of that that makes him feel so good. He'd whistle and sing and have a good time for about 30 minutes. So one day, Dad wasn't home. Mama's gone. And I went in the pantry, stripped down the bag, screwed off the lid, took a drink, sang the same song that Dad sang, and the miracle of alcohol took place in my life. Now, I've heard it said, I've heard people from these podiums say it blew off their fingernails and went out their toes and smoked out their ears. Well, you know, it never did do that to me, but here's what happened. I hated my daddy. I hated him so much that when he was drafted into the Second World War, I prayed for him every day. I prayed that he'd get killed, that he wouldn't come back. Because when he wasn't at home, mama wasn't fussing, and it was kind of quiet. But when I had a drink, I liked daddy. And when I had a drink, mama wasn't bad. And when I had a drink, it didn't matter if I lived in Kannapolis, and it didn't make any difference if they called me a linthead. I really didn't care where I lived when I had a drink. And when I had a drink, I did all those good things that I thought were good. So I set out after that first drink to make certain, even at the age of 13, that I wasn't going to ever be without having a drink. I was expelled from school, I think, long before they ever came up with that word to use in classrooms, because I had showed up several days junior high drinking and sleeping and passing out, and they just sent me home. And one day the principal said, when I was 16, "Ray, if I were you, I just wouldn't even come back." And I didn't. I just went to work in the mill like everybody else in my hometown and worked there for a number of years. Something happened when I was about 17, 18 years old. I met my wife, and she was the prettiest thing that I'd ever seen. And she lived the other side of the track. Now, Southern Railway ran straight through the town of Kannapolis, and on the far side, on the south side, were those folks who owned their own homes. They didn't live in mill villages. And I met this young lady one night, and she, when I looked at her, I knew she had what I wanted, and I was going to go to Indianapolis to get it. But she lived on the other side of town. And her family owned an automobile, which was a unique experience in the early 40s in Kannapolis. And I set out to get what that young lady had, and we fell in love with each other, and we got married. We were too young. I was 19, and she was 19. Just turned 19. Still drinking and still having trouble with alcohol early in my life. I was an alcoholic. But I didn't drink much because my wife didn't allow drinking in the family. I married the woman just like my mother, you know, the same old song, "Just Like Mama." And so I didn't drink much when she was around, but when she wasn't around, that's when I did my drinking. At age 22, I had an experience that I'll have to describe like this. I didn't go to church. When I prayed for my dad to get killed and not come back, the God that I understood then didn't allow him to get killed because he didn't answer my prayers. So God and I, that I understood, ceased having relationships. I just didn't talk to God anymore. Didn't go to church, had never been a part of the church. But at age 22, something happened to me. God got me from the rear end. And I don't know if y'all understand these words in Minnesota, but I had a conversion experience. You know, understand? I was saved. My life was altered. I know today that I had a spiritual experience, and I wasn't in church. So God got me from the rear end, and I didn't know where he came from. But here I was, and he had me, and I began to be a part of the church that I knew. And my wife and I both started to attend church, and then coupled with that was the call to the Christian ministry. And I responded to that call after a period of time and had to go back to high school and then to college and then on to seminary. So for about 14 years, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't dance. I almost never looked at women, but those were early years. Now, what happened in those years for me was that I was a clean, living young man. The alcohol problem that I had no longer was a part of my life because I had a spiritual experience. Now, what I didn't do, I didn't do an inventory. I didn't do a fifth step. I didn't know anything about that stuff that I know now. And maybe 14 years later, after I had served some student appointments in the Methodist Church, I had my first full-time church, and I was a young minister on the way up in the church, and doing good and being looked at by our conference officials as being one of the most promising young men around. And then one night at a party, somebody said, "Do you drink?" And for some reason, I said, "Yes." And I hadn't in a long time. And I took a drink. Now, I didn't know then, but I know today, that alcoholism that was in abeyance because I didn't drink, because of a spiritual experience in the church, was now turned back on. And it didn't take long. I was 33 years old when I took that drink again. I picked it up, took it, and I never stopped wanting another one until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at age 49. And those years were years that I drank alcoholically in the church and alcoholically outside the church. Now, one lady said to me once, how did you do that? And I said, well, it was after a meeting like this. And I said, how did I do what? And she said, how did you drink and you were a man of God? Well, I said, what do you do for a living? And she said, I teach school. And I said, well, are you an alcoholic? And she said, I am. I said, did you ever go to school drinking? One morning, did you take a drink before you went? She said, sure. I said, how did you do that? You know, I did what I had to do. I drank because I had to drink, and I had to work in order to drink. And it didn't make any difference what my profession was. I did a good job. I look back on a lot of those activities that I was involved in and the ministries that I conducted and did a good job. One of the things I had to quit doing, though, and I didn't realize this for a long time, but I had to quit preaching from the pulpit, like now, looking down at you. You see, I had gotten involved after a period of time with my alcoholism that I was, preacher's responsibility is to preach against sin. And doggone, I was about doing everything that I was supposed to be preaching about. And it got harder and harder to preach from the pulpit about those things that I was doing myself. So I asked the bishop, powerful man, the bishop in the Methodist church, and I went to see him, and I wanted to get away from the pulpit ministry. So I asked him if he'd help me find or let me have a special ministry in an inner city where I could work with people that I didn't have to preach to. And he allowed it. I found out how powerful alcohol is working when it works in the life of a person. It's persuasive, even to someone as powerful as the bishop. And I heard you last night, Malachi, how we manipulate powerful people with our drinking. So I began the road of working outside the local church. I had jobs in the inner city ministry, in the Yokefella prison ministry, in the state of North Carolina in those years when I was drinking, not having to preach to people. Now, I can only have to mention this, and we all understand it. It began to create problems with my wife and I. I said to her one night in the drunken stupor, the lady that I love so much, Betty, I don't love you anymore. And it's hard for someone to love you when you say to them, I don't love you anymore. And so we moved through a lot of tough years, and eventually I was working for the state of North Carolina in a special appointment by the church. And I was a regional director, and I had a lot of people working with me in the 70s and working for me. And it seemed to me like everybody that I worked with or everybody that worked for me had a divorce. It just seemed that way. And Betty and I weren't getting along too well, so I just asked her if she would give me a divorce. And she did. I think she was ready to get rid of me. So I got a divorce. Now, one of the things that, two things that happened to me when I left my family. I walked away from the woman that I loved so much and two children that I loved. Now, they were, my daughter was older, but my son was younger. I walked away from them because I look now and I know that I was in love with alcohol and I wanted to drink like I wanted to drink and drink when I wanted to drink. So what I did was left that family and got me a swinging singles apartment. And I was 42 years old. I had never swung in my life. I got married when I was 19 and a preacher right after that, and I had never done any swinging. So I got me a swinging singles apartment in a place over in Greensboro, North Carolina, called the Hilton West. Just kind of sounds right, doesn't it? Now, the next thing I did was to go to the, buy me a little furniture, but I bought me a bar. Methodist parsonages do not come equipped with bars, and I'd never had one, and I wanted one, and I left my family, and I got me a bar and a swinging singles apartment, and I set that bar up. Now, I had always had trouble buying liquor. Preachers have a hard time buying alcohol in our part of the country. We have a little isolated stores called ABC stores in North Carolina. alcoholic beverage control. And those stores are put in strip malls most of the time. You got one by an Advance store. And it took me forever to get a bottle. I'd sit there and wait so that nobody would be in that ABC store, and I'd run in. I'd get me a bottle and I'd run out. And I spent more time waiting to try to get in to get it than I did drinking the stuff. So now I don't have a church. I don't have a family. And I got me a bar. And I go to one of these self-serve deals and I get me a buggy. And I remember I drank out of the jar the way I learned, and later graduated to the bottle the way I learned. And I never drank anything mixed in my life. And I go in the store and buy all this pretty stuff to put in my bar, bring it back to the apartment, set it up. Best of my knowledge, nobody. I don't recall anybody ever coming to have a drink with me. I didn't swing at all. I played bingo one night at the clubhouse, and that didn't go too well. But my destination, my purpose was being fulfilled. I wanted to drink like I wanted to drink. The way I drank in that condo, with about 20 steps up from where the old drinking chair was in the bar, was the bedroom, mattress on the floor where I was going to do all the swinging. And in the closet, on the floor, in the right-hand part of the closet, set a bottle. And when I wanted to drink, I walked up the steps, reached into the little closet, poured me out a glass full, and walked down the steps. I don't know who I was hiding from. Maybe God? Well, that didn't last long. No swinging, no activity. I moved to... Well, I was in a point in my drinking that I really was doing a lot of crazy things, so I moved on the other side of town. A little cheaper place, no possibility of swinging here. I went to a senior citizens community. I'm 43 years old, and I get me an apartment in a senior citizens housing group. Lady next door, about 10 years older than me, was the only person I could find that drank. And she came over once in a while and would drink 2 beers. That was her limit. Well, and I'm just getting warmed up about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I'm needing to drink on for a while, and she goes home, and you know, I spend those, the big book talks about that loneliness that only an alcoholic knows. My wife said, we know loneliness too. As the family members, but I know the loneliness of an alcoholic when nobody will talk to you on the phone and nobody will come to see you, and you reach that point in your life when you have no friends. I'm sitting there one night in that little apartment thinking about how lonely I am, and my ex-wife has told me, if you call one more time, I'll call the police. And I wouldn't want anything to do with that. People on the West Coast got tired of hearing about me and tired of talking with me, and none of my friends were talking. I don't know about you, but I had some brilliant ideas when I was drinking, especially after midnight. Brilliant ideas. I got this brilliant idea that evening that I would get somebody to the house to take care of that loneliness that was tearing my soul out. So I loaded up a double-barrel shotgun with buckshot. And I walked out in front of the house, and I shot the window out. I didn't tell this for years. I shot the window out in that bedroom. I ran back into the house, hid the gun, got in the bed, and fell out on the floor. Picked up the telephone and said to the police that I had called, somebody is shooting at me. Now, you might not have been this insane, but if you dig deep enough, you're going to see some insanity that you might have gone through like this. I walked to the front door, and it wasn't 3 minutes that 3 squad cars pulled up. Lights flashing, sirens going. They jumped out with the guns in their hand. I ran back in the house, hoped they wouldn't find the gun. They looked all over the place. They came in and got the story, and I'm telling them exactly what happened. You know, we make up good ones, and I had a good one going. My plan worked, because when I walked out the door with that detective that night in that front yard with all those little senior citizens, there must have been 25 or 30 of them standing out in the yard, And for the next 3-4 months, they were down at my house every night. Some of them even came, brought their bottle with them. And we talked about who shot at you. And, you know, the longer that story went, and I got mileage, more mileage out of it. Now, you can tell I'm coming to the end of my drinking because it's getting bad. I have a job with the state of North Carolina in those days, and it was because of the political affiliation that I got the job, and that political affiliation was now changing, and I was about to lose my job. And alcoholics are smart. We think ahead, you know. We plan ahead. And I thought, I'm going to be without work, and I'm going to be without ability to buy something to drink, so I better get busy. I called the bishop, and I said, Bishop, I want to come back to the church. I want to have a little church in the country. I believe if you'd give me a couple little rural churches, I'd do a good job. And he said, come down to see me. And that was about a 100-mile trip from where I was to his office in Charlotte. I had a fifth in my car, and I had several shooters before I got there. I walked into his office, and I knew I was in trouble as soon as I looked at his desk. My records were on the desk, and they were thicker than the big book. And I knew I was in trouble. I sat down with this fellow. He's a gentleman from Mississippi, black gentleman, and I explained to him what I wanted, and he said to me, Ray, aren't you divorced? And I said, Bishop Allen, I was right proud of that. You know, I was the only Methodist minister that I knew that had a divorce, and I was proud of it. And I kind of squared up and said, Bishop, I am. And he said, well, I've never appointed a divorce preacher to anything, and I don't intend to start. And, you know, we think pretty quick on our feet. And I said, well, Bishop, I am about to get married. And he said, who are you going to marry? Well, he had me nailed, and I said, I am going to remarry my wife, Betty. And he liked Betty. He said, you know, if you can do that, Ray, I'll give you a church. Well, sounded good to me, and I had 100 miles to get back to the road, and I had about a half a fifth to do it, and by the time I got to Greensboro, I had conceived the most magnificent plan in the world, and that was to remarry my wife, my ex-wife. So I started wining her and dining her. I spent more money on her than I'd ever spent, and I haven't spent that much since. And one night we were sitting in the restaurant, and the lights were low, and the candles were lit, and I'm about half crocked. And I said to her, Betty, will you remarry me? I'm going to tell you, Al-Anons who are here, pre-Al-Anon, I'm going to tell you how crazy you were. This woman was rid of me. I'm out of her life. And she sat there in the quietness of those moments knowing that I am just about drunk. And she says, I will. And we did. Both my kids stood up for me. I got married to the superintendent. I wanted the bishop to get the word. And I did. And he gave me 3 churches, you know. I said, what am I going to do? I was, you know, it was embarrassing to have 3 churches. And then I moved, all of them were around the lake. And I found out it was a drinking man's paradise. People over at this church would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you lately. I said, well, I've been visiting these people over here. And these people over here said, we haven't seen you lately, Reverend. I said, I've been visiting these people here. And what was happening in my life is I'm laid up down at the lake drunk most of the time. I went there fully intending never to take another drink. I've got my wife back. We're remarried. My son's at home. My daughter's talking to me again. And for 3 months, I white-knuckled it and didn't drink. And those folks liked me, and I began to like them. It was a nice, comfortable place. On Labor Day of 1979, the next-door neighbor, 2 or 3 houses, or well, the next door, just a block or 2 away from me, he's Presbyterian. I didn't drink with Methodists, but he's Presbyterian. And he said, Reverend, do you drink? On a Sunday afternoon, and I said, well, once in a while, Richard, I do take a drink. And he said, we're having a party tomorrow. Why don't you come over? And I did. And they carried me home. And that started the last 3 years of my alcoholism and the worst 3 years that I ever lived. And I say this not because I don't think you'll understand. I know you'll understand. But I I preached funerals of people that I didn't even know died. And I married young couples that I had no idea that I married them. And I officiated at the sacrament, the holy sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And I didn't hardly know what I was doing. I was drunk. And I walked from that split chancel from one side to the other to preach and almost would not make it. Now, you know I did that because I could not do it. Well, you know, that didn't last long. One day, I ran to the end of it. And I called a psychiatrist in a town not far from there that I'd been seeing for 10 years. Now, I'd been getting treatment for my drinking. The only thing is that he didn't know I was drinking. He was treating me for some other problem that had nothing to do with alcohol. And I called him and I told him over the phone that I was drinking too much and I needed some help. And he said, well, come over and I'll put you in the hospital. Well, I'd been there 3 times into the psych hospital. So I went again. No, they lock you up in those places. How many of you have ever been in a psych? Well, a few of you. If you haven't been as a patient, you ought to go. You ought to try. See what you miss. I went drunk because I wouldn't go otherwise, and I went drunk, and they locked me up, and they do lock the door. You can't get out. Now, the next morning, the stark reality sets in that those people who are there have a basic problem that's not like your problem. And if you're not careful, they're going to put you with them, and you'll not get back over here. So I started getting better as soon as I could, and about 3 days, I thought they put me on the staff. Literally, I was trying to manage people. You know, that was pretty good. I could do that pretty well. And I was helping them out with those people who needed to be in the psychiatric hospital, but they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. 3 days, you know, we detox and we come alive. We look good, and the psychiatrist is scratching his head because I'm telling him that I don't drink. One day, there were about 14 adolescents on that wing. We have rare snows in North Carolina, but in the early part of 1980, it snowed big. And I was in the psych hospital, and I said to the staff, if you would let me take some pots or bowls outside, then we'll get some ice, some snow, and we'll make ice snow for the kids. Well, they never heard of it, and they thought it'd be very therapeutic. So I got these 14 kids on the elevator, and we go downstairs, and nobody can get in and because of the snow, and nobody can get out, so we got the whole parking lot, and I lost them. And I finally found them, and all 14 of them sitting in a little huddle, smoking something. And they said, come on, Pop, and they got me in the middle, and every time they smoked it, they passed it to me, and first thing you know, I'm flying up about the 12th story, and they're there, and I finally get them together and get them on the elevator. And the thought comes to me, this was a moment of truth. And I know it was, for most people it couldn't possibly be, but it was a moment of truth. On that elevator with those 14 drugged kids that they had gotten me drugged, as we started toward the 9th floor, I thought, Ray, you're a damn fool. You are wasting time, money, and energy, and here you are. And I began to do an evaluation of my life. I had the nurse to call the doctor and explain to him what I was doing. I had been given a leave to go outside. And you don't give an alcoholic a pass to go outside and tell him, don't get in trouble. And you know what I did? I went to the bar and I picked me up a fifth, put it in my belt, and came back. And I'd been drinking. And I told him about it, and he denied it. And the next morning, I'd had a couple of shooters, and he came over, and I blew my breath in his face, and he discharged me. And I went back to the old house by myself. My wife had left again. Nobody was there. They'd even taken the cat with them this time. Nothing there. And I made the decision not ever to get sober again. And I went out and bought all that I could with what I had and stored it there and never intended to quit. Now, the miracle of my miracle is like yours. It started when I had nothing to do with it. My wife, who still loved me, and an only friend that I had, a minister friend of mine, met together secretly and asked that question that we've been asked a lot about us. What are we going to do with him? What are we going to do with Ray? And they remembered an old boy that they had known who was a good friend of mine at one time, but I hadn't seen him in years. His name was Bob. And they called Bob. And they had no idea that Bob was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was not mentioned. He didn't mention it to them. But he came, and Bob put me in his automobile and had a magic word to say when he set me down in the car. He said, "You know, Ray, I'm going to stop down the road and get you a bottle." And that's all I needed to hear. And then he told me we were going to a hospital, and we left. Now, I don't remember getting to that hospital, but I remember the next morning, because it was cold and I was confused. I had no idea where I was, didn't know how I got there, looked out the window and there was snow on the ground, didn't recognize a soul. Tried to find a paper and there wasn't one, turned on the TV and there wasn't one, you know, no TV. So I said, as soon as somebody comes in this room, I'm going to ask so that they won't know where I am. I'm going to find out without them knowing. Little nurse came in, dressed in a beautiful little white uniform, and I had been sick and had vomited all over myself, and she walked over to the bed and said to me, "Can I help you?" And I said to her, "Where am I?" And this is what this little girl said, "Reverend Moss, when you were my mom and daddy's preacher, you baptized me. Now I wanted to die and couldn't die. And I said to her, 'For God's sake, honey, who's my doctor?' And she told me, and I couldn't believe it. And a couple hours later, the doctor, who was about my age, came and sat down on the side of the bed and stuck his hand out, and he had delivered my son, and he had given me sleeping pills years before, and he put his hand in mine, and he said, 'Ray, my name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.'" Well, old Bob had brought me there, and another Bob was now taking care of me, and he said, "We're going to send you to a treatment program." I had no idea what they were going to treat, but anyway, I was going. And the old 12-stepper, I'll never forget Bob. Bob Wynn, he died a couple of years ago, but he came back another 50 miles and put me back in his car and drove me another 50 miles to a treatment program and sat and waited on me, waited until they admitted me, and said to me, "Don't worry, I'll be back." In a couple of weeks, he came back. And you know, he never told me, he never said, "Ray, you're a bad man." He never kicked me. Other people were. But he never did. He just simply told me what had happened to him. And I've never forgotten Bob. And we'll never forget him. I stayed in that treatment program about 42 days. Now that was in the 80s, and normal stay was 28, but they said, "Ray, you're sicker than other people." That's the first time I'd ever heard that. "Ray, you're sicker than most people." So I stayed 42 days, and when I left there, I came out armed with two things. I came out knowing what Alcoholics Anonymous was because they had introduced me to AA. And I knew what the big book was. And I knew that the big book had the steps in it. That was on March 24th, 1980. I left that treatment program. I was going to go see my superintendent and take those three churches and straighten all those people out. And when I sat down in his office, he said, "Ray, the bishop and I have decided to put you on leave of absence." Now, don't you think that was anything less than firing me? They just simply don't. What do you do with a drunk preacher? Now, our denomination doesn't handle it well, not in those days. I left that place and drove to my mama's house, to Kannapolis, little mill house that I hated so much, and walked in and sat down with a woman that I didn't like and said to her, "Mama, God, I swallowed all the pride that I'd ever had." And I said, "Mama, can I stay with you?" Now, listen, I didn't say, "Can I live with you?" There's a difference. I just wanted to stay a little while. And this is what that old woman said to me. Ray, you can if you don't drink. And I threw a mattress on the floor in the back bedroom and I stayed there. But let me tell you what happened that night, March 24th. I walked into the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I went to on my own. Now, they'd taken me in those vans. Those vans, you know, they, God knows, they didn't have a window in it, you know. And I thought, boy, I'm in a bad condition here. But I went myself. I had the address from the treatment program of where it met in that little town. And I walked into the Catholic church and little fellowship hall. I was scared to death. I was sweating all over. My heart was flying. And I thought, you know, if they ask me where I live and I have to tell them I live with my mother and I'm 49 years old, I won't come back. And if they ask me if I'm married and I have to tell them that I don't have a wife, I won't come back. And by God, if they ask me where I work and I have to tell them I got fired today, I won't come back. And so they didn't ask me a thing. They really didn't want to hear anything I had to say. Now, what happened? There were 16 folks there that night and they gave me 16 names. Now, they didn't give it to me on little slips of paper where I'd lose it. They gave it to me on a big sheet where an alcoholic can keep up with it. And they said phone number and name, and they said, call us if you need us. Or if you don't need it. And they meant it. And I knew it. And I started going. I went the next night to another meeting. And I got comfortable. And I found me a sponsor, old George, who said he'd work with me. I told you last night, he's never told me to do a thing. He just walked ahead of me and showed me how to do it. He told me I had to make amends. I was about 3 months in the program, and we had walked through the steps. Now, my sponsor carried me rapidly through the steps. I don't know how you do that, but he carried me rapidly through the steps. He showed me in the big book where Bill and Bob third stepped the guy on the first day in the hospital, and this fellow was still in the hospital, and he said, Ray, you can do it. And Ray, you can do it. And he kept saying that, and I kept sitting there working them, and we just worked through them. And in 3 months, I was ready to do some amends work. Didn't want to. I really didn't want to do it. Now, I thought I had made my amends to God, that I had offended Him so much with my destroying my own life. I had made my amends to myself, but I had not made amends to anyone else. And George said, Ray, you got to do it. And he said, you got to do it right. So, my wife was living with her mother. And I'm living with my mother, staying there. And we didn't have but one automobile, and she's riding the meetings with me. Now, she's been in Al-Anon longer than I've been in AA now. But she didn't get close. She sat far to the right. She remembered that night when the lights were low and the candles were lit. She didn't want to have anything to do with me. But I said to her one night, Betty, I need to talk with you. And she was in the program long enough to know what I need to talk about. And I said, maybe we can stop off at Burger King. Hell, you can do your amends anywhere. It don't make any difference if it's Burger King or an office. So at Burger King, with a little table about as big as this podium, I sat there with her, and my heart was thumping, and I'm sweating, and I'm scared to death. And I reached across and took her hand in mine and looked at her straight in the eye. And this was a woman I devastated with my drinking. I said to her, Betty, I want to make amends to you. And she stopped me, looked me straight in the eye, and with tears running down her cheeks, said to me, Ray, it's okay. It's been okay. You know where she learned that? She learned it around the tables and in the chairs at Al-Anon. Not too much later after that, I was able to do the very same thing to my daddy. My dad never stopped drinking all those years. And I was 4 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous living in South Carolina, and he called me and said, son, I'm sick. And I thought he was physically sick, and I went the next day to see him. Went into his house where he lived alone, and liquor bottles were all over the place. And he'd been drunk for 3 months, and he only weighed 140 pounds, and he was about to die. And he said to me, I need to see the doctor. And I said, I'll take you. And he said, no, I've got a problem with my alcohol, with my drinking. And he had never said that to me. And I grabbed that little man's butt up, and I put him in the back seat of my car, and I took him to the VA hospital to the treatment program. He stayed there 3 months, and he got sober. And I gave him every kip he ever picked up. He called me about 7 or 8 months into sobriety and said, I need to see you, son. And I kind of knew where he was in his program, and I drove the next couple of days up to my sister's house, and he was sitting there at the table with his little arthritic hands, and he's dying with cancer. And he reached across the table and said to me, with tears coming down his cheeks, I want to ask you to forgive me for those years that I wasn't a daddy. And I looked that old man in the eye and squeezed his hands and said to him just exactly what Betty said to me, it's okay. I'd never hugged him in my life, and I got up and he stood up and I reached around him and hugged him. And he and I cried together. And I gave him his year chip. I gave him his every chip that he got, and he died before he got his 6-year chip. I had it bought, but he was in the hospital, and we were going to take a meeting to him, but he died before we could get the meeting there. And in the funeral parlor, I slipped that chip in his pocket while he lay there in the casket and put my hand on his and said, Dad, you're cold sober. He would have liked that. I'm going to tell you about my first birthday. Now, I can't remember my last birthday. I really can't. I can't remember my 10th birthday. I can't remember my 15th birthday. But I can remember my first birthday. Can you? My sponsor tells me if you can't remember your last drunk and your first birthday, you're in trouble. And I can remember them both. It was on Saturday night at the Canapolis group of Alcoholics Anonymous. 200 people showed up that night to see me pick up a chip. They came to the meeting, you know, and I just happened to get a chip. What a fellowship. And let me tell you who was there. I stayed sober 365 days, and my wife was there. We'd gotten everything back in place. My son was there. My daughter was there. My mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my mother, my sister. Those people that I had hurt so much were there to see me get that first anniversary chip. And Bob, the old 12-stepper, came and he shared his story. And then I picked up my chip and I looked for my son, who was a strapping submariner in the Navy. He left home at 17 as soon as he finished high school, and he's told me later to get his ass away from me, and I don't blame him. But there he sat. But when the meeting was over, he was gone. And I looked for him and couldn't find him. And then I remembered that I had taught him, just like my daddy taught me, that men don't hug each other and men don't cry. And he couldn't stay in that crowd if he didn't hug or cry, because that's what was happening that night. And I walked to the back door and looked out across the street there, and down in the far corner of the parking lot under the lights, he stood. And I got down off of those steps and walked toward him, and he walked toward me. And we got in a little trot. And when we got close to each other, we reached out and embraced. And he said to me, you're the best daddy in the whole world. About 4 years prior to that night, he had loaded a gun and put it to my head and was going to kill me because I had, in a drunken stupor, slapped his mama. See, I just prayed that my daddy would get killed. Now, he was going to kill me. But that night, under the lights, he said, you're the best daddy in the whole world. And you know what it took to get that from that boy? Go to meetings, don't drink, read the big book, and work with other alcoholics. What a wonderful night that was. Now, I've had many more birthdays, but that was a wonderful experience in itself. I moved to Florida. I thought I'd never get another job. I went to work in the cotton mill. It's the only place. You know, I applied for jobs. I don't know. I looked everywhere. And when I'd go for an interview, I had a blank spot in there about 19 years. I didn't put in there that I'd been preaching, you know. I didn't want them to know that I'd been doing anything like that. So they wanted to know, so what did you do in this period of time? And I said, well, I'm a Methodist preacher. Well, they said, we're not hiring preachers today, you know. We just don't need you. Had a hard time finding a job, but my sister-in-law got me a job on the third shift, you know, that's 11 at night, 7 in the morning, in the cotton mill, and a hard job, physical job. And I'd never worked really in a long time, not physically. And I kept that job 9 months. Man, I loved that job. I really did. It was a good job. Didn't pay much. Paid $4.75 an hour. But I didn't drink anymore. I didn't run around anymore. I didn't need any money. We saved a little money. But I had a call from a friend of mine who offered me a job. And it was in another state. And I went to Florida. And while I was in Florida for that period of time, I picked up the paper one Sunday morning and read that the Bishop Earl Hunt, the Methodist Church, was now the bishop in the Florida Conference. And that was the bishop that was my bishop when I was running crazy. I tried to go back to those churches that I had offended so many people. That was an amends that I couldn't make, and I had tried to go back to those churches. I'd asked one reverend to let me come back and just stand up in a general way, apologize to them. And he said, "Hell no. You've done enough damage in this church." And I didn't get to go. So I didn't close the door. I kept it open. And I thought, you know, the Methodist church, like the Catholic church and other churches with bishops, the bishop's the head of the church. Now, God helped me understand that if I could just make those amends to the bishop who's the head of the church, maybe that'd work. And I'd do it to the people if I could. So I wrote the bishop a long letter. Told him I need to see him and why, and he wrote me back and said, "Ray, I'm glad you're alive. I thought you was dead. But you don't owe me an apology." He missed the point. So I drove over to Lakeland, and I sat with that man of God for 4 hours and did a fifth step with him. I shared everything, all the wrongs that I'd done, all the harms that I'd done in the church, and he graciously accepted that amend. Now, since that time, I've had the chance to go back to those churches because they've invited me to be their speaker on special Sunday. And I've been able to work with some of the members of those churches who have a problem with alcohol. The program has actually worked in my life in every respect. I have a 13-year-old grandson now. He has known all his life that I'm in the program of recovery from my alcoholism. He was visiting when he was just a little fella, about 3 and a half. And he was trying to please Grandpa. And I'm going to work that morning, and he comes to the door as I start out the door, and he says to me, "Papa, be easy." He almost had it. So he has known all along. And we've tried to help him understand that there's so much alcoholism in my family. Everybody on my dad's side has a problem with alcohol. Some of them have died from alcoholism. Everybody except my son, and it may be too early in life to determine that yet. But I've tried to help him understand, my grandson, that he could potentially have a problem. He taught me a lesson one day, and it helped me focus for the rest of my life on what I want to do. I've been able, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, to retire. Retired at age 62, almost 4.5 years ago now. And moved back to that little town of Kannapolis. Swore to God if I ever got out of it, I'd never go back. But I'm back there, and we're happy, and we're doing the kind. I bought me a mill house. Bought me a little mill house. Doesn't have a pantry. Don't need it anymore. But my little grandson was riding with me when he was about 12 years old, 11 years old. I keep a big book in the front of my seat where I used to keep a fifth. And that little boy picked up that big book one morning when we were just riding around town, and I'm telling him some stories that he likes to hear. And he said, "Papa, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, Darrell, it is." And I said, why don't you turn to page 58 and read a little bit?" And he started reading. "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." Read right on through the steps. And while that young man read, tears ran down my cheeks because I said, "I may never be able to see him go to university, but by God, I have introduced that young man to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He knows what it's about." While we rode, I thought, you know, for the rest of my life, what am I going to do? I don't work anymore. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? And it just dawned on me that the primary purpose is to stay sober. But it has a second part to it, to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And the only way I can help other alcoholics achieve sobriety is to stay sober. And the only way I can stay sober is to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And it's that circle. So I said, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life in my little town to helping alcoholics stay sober so that I can stay sober myself. And I started doing that. I started doing that in every way I can, not only going to meetings, but at my church, the church that I attend, they've allowed me to have a title on the bulletin, the Minister of Counseling. You hear that? The Minister of Counseling. They set me up a little office there. Now, I don't counsel anybody except alcoholics and their families, because other ministers don't want to deal with that. They really don't know how to deal with it. So I get all kind of calls from different kind of people, different ministers, referring those folks. And they usually refer to them as, we've got another family that needs some help. They don't say what the problem is. They just know that I know what the problem is. We do 12-step studies. We run them for 3-4 months at a time, every Wednesday evening, 2 hours a night, studying the 12 steps from the big book. And we've had the last one, we had 16 people there, which was a pretty good crowd. Doing 12-step work, it's something to teach. It's something to teach your sponsorees, and that's how to do a 12-step call. I wouldn't know if George hadn't have showed me. We don't do it much anymore, but once in a while we get a live one, and we go. I take some of the boys, sometimes two or three of them. They want to see it. It's like a circus, you know. They've never seen a drunk. They've never seen one in a motel room. I took one old boy the other week or so. Had a call from this fella, and he'd been coming to AA, but he couldn't quite get it, and he called me, and he was at the local motel, you know, one of those little mom-and-pop deals. And we went, and Gene went with me, and we knocked on the door, and he said, come on in, you know, didn't have it locked. And we walk in, and this is the view. He's lying in his, with his skivvies in the bed with his bottle and a pack of cigarettes. And the bottle's about half full. And we talk to him a while. And Gene says, OJ, are you ready to go somewhere and get some help? And he looks at the bottle, and he looks at Gene, and he said, no, not yet, because the bottle's still half full. But anyway, that's what I've been doing in these last years, and what I'm going to continue to do in my sobriety. If it hadn't been for Bob Wendt, the 12-stepper, I wouldn't be here tonight. I don't want to ever forget that. If it hadn't been for George, my sponsor, I wouldn't be here today. If it hadn't been for those folks who helped me stay in the program, I wouldn't be here. And I want to be there when they need me. I want to remember that there is a primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is for me to stay sober and for me to work with other alcoholics to help them achieve sobriety. And if I do that one, I can say this, do this, and if I do this, I can do that. And that's the way it is with me. I thank you for listening. You're a good group. You smile a lot. You're happy people. You're young folks. And you just keep coming back, and you can be sober 50 years a day at a time. A lot of you here that can be sober 50 years a day at a time. Thank you for the invite. Thank you, Steve.